Right. Any feedback from your discussion? I'm aware that I gave kind of fairly vague kind of sort of question to you, but maybe you had some discussion you could share with me. Any points to make, Mark? Charlotte? More time at the gym. Okay, that's all right. You know, my question was vague. I mean, it's just in my mind there's different ways of approaching these things. You know, I agree completely with the diagnosis, you know, that somehow we're seeing the impure as pure. What's suffering to be happiness? You know, the impermanent to be permanent. And then what has a self to, what doesn't have a self to have a self? I mean, agree with it. It's not like you realize anything, but that seems to be the right way to go. This is when you're trying to pin down what the ignorance that's holding us back is. That seems to be kind of more or less it, but maybe you haven't come to that conclusion yourself. But what do you, how do you feel you should tackle that in meditation? Have you got anything to offer? Yes, Francesco, is it? Uh-huh, you have you, see? There is somebody who knows about this sort of thing. Yeah, okay. Yeah, so you were sitting for long periods of time, long sessions. Yes, it must be very arduous. I've never had a, you know, done meditation for that length of time. You were in Burma or?
No, in here, yeah.
In England. And when you're meditating on the breath, are you meditating at the nostrils or at the abdomen or? Yes, that was kind of a, well, it's an innovation, although it's probably a classic thing now, of the Burmese method, yeah. So you don't do it at the, if you're meditating on the breath, not at the nostrils, but here. But it's interesting to have you to confirm that. And then, yes, as it seems to be the case, that mainly you keep meditating on your chosen object, such as, you know, the breath, and you allow the insights into feelings or mind or whatever to come along from just that one object. So you can say there are four close placements of mindfulness, but it doesn't mean you spend as sort of time on doing them all, kind of as them as your main focus. You're doing one and letting the others come in when they arise, you know.
Yeah. I think it's just when you're settling in, and it seems that after moments of rising, moments of falling, and the insight of no self is supposed to be, obviously, you see that the body is not, you know, the observer isn't the observed. And then, so you kind of have that separation between the body and the knower. Apparently, the knower is just supposed to disappear.
Well, sounds like you did very well, though. So you have, I mean, I don't think there's usually the order is there, isn't it, impermanence? And from greater and greater sensitivity to impermanence, then the realization of suffering arises. And then later on, yeah, eventually insight into no self too. So there's a sort of sequence. But were they actually teaching you, like, oh yeah, look out for impermanence, or look out for suffering at this point? Or were they just saying, not even giving you any instructions?
No, there was instruction. So, and you had interviews, one-to-one interviews back in the day, so you kind of checking up on where you were and what you're feeling. But, you know, I think it was like a 10-day retreat, so the bulk of that time is just people falling asleep in pain. Only kind of towards the end, you know, you're starting to see the feeling characteristic of you wanting or not pushing away, the kind of attachment or aversion to certain sensations in the body. And you do walk in meditation, but you do it very, very slowly, so you're noticing the intention to move, and kind of moving forward with the right foot and placing, so you're starting to bring everything down to very slow levels.
So, did you ever go back?
Yeah. I'm going to go actually next month.
Oh, yeah. And where is this place?
Well, it's an English monk. He did a retreat at Guy House, but he's got a retreat centre in Shrewsbury.
Yeah. Good. Well, that's you know, kind of coming from the other side. You know, we're on Dharamsala, kind of studying away, doing this sort of, you know, madcap debate and stuff. So debate's not on the menu. I mean, sorry, meditation's not on the menu. You know, your prayers in the morning, but that's just chanting. That's like trying to lift your spirits to this high level of Maitreya's, you know, beautiful compassion, sort of, and then. Otherwise, you're sort of debating or preparing your reading your studies or texts or memorizing. So there's no time in which you sit down, even certainly as a group of monks, and start meditating. Of course, if you want to on your own, nobody thinks that's wrong. But in the crowded situation in the monastery, well, didn't. You weren't really able to do much. And no time, really. So the idea is much more given over to get your intellectual capacity going through developing a path of reasoning, you know, that's sort of the style of the monastery I was in. So it's quite different. So that's what intrigues me, you know. So did you have any other discussions? Anybody else got a kind of experience of mindfulness meditation that could be relevant here? Have you been on any retreats in Burma, Stuart? Thailand?
I went to a retreat here once. Mindfulness. Not a retreat, yeah, but a weekend. Which was, it was feeling that for a while. But that was just sitting.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so that's obviously going to be one benefit of mindfulness meditation, is you're just going to pacify your mind a little bit, which is probably for most people in the West a very good thing. You know, so it's a method of relaxing and kind of, you know, de-stressing the mind. And that's very much how, that's very much its appeal to a lot of people, isn't it, these days? It has become a popular thing. And not just sort of popular as a pastime, but, you know, groups of people like it's something they can do, you know, some kind of something that their employers might pay for, you know, that they have their kind of employees, you know, it's the opportunity to do some mindfulness meditation, maybe organised by their employers as a sort of a way to make them more efficient at work, or a way to de-stress them or something. You know, it's one of those things that people are trying out, isn't it? So whether it's on that level of just pacifying the mind and making the mind refreshed and making the mind calmer, that's great, you know, that'll be fine. So even if you don't have any background of the Four Noble Truths and the presentation of cyclic existence, those methods are useful, then they should be used, and that's great, that's fine. I mean, I have a friend in Sheffield, he teaches mindfulness meditation. I've never been to one of his sessions, but when you start talking to him about past and future lives and samsara, he sort of not really interested, you know, and the sort of meditation group he set up in the beginning was a Zen Buddhist meditation group. And it's still going, you know, so it's... But they don't talk about past and future lives, so they're not using the mindfulness to investigate to that length, to that depth. I think they're trying to go beyond just mere relaxing your mind and calming your mind and sort of using mindfulness as a sort of therapy on that level. I think they, you know, they're Zen Buddhists, they should be looking for some kind of awakening or some kind of, I don't know, moving beyond the conceptual, whatever it is that Zen Buddhists are really going for. Again, that's another kind of Buddhism and not really practiced. So yeah, there's that kind of approach. But here, you know, in the Burmese tradition, in our tradition, you know, these things are being practiced sort of to try to get to the bottom of the issue, aren't they? Right? Where is our suffering coming from? And the answer's been given, and we've got to try and get to that answer. So you don't leave it with just sort of a more superficial level. You don't leave it at the sort of the goal is not so quite so profound. You want to get to the root of suffering. You want to understand the Four Noble Truths. I mean, that's why we're practicing them. That's why we're being thrown into psychic existence, because of our wrong ideas, wrong conceptions. So how do we get rid of those wrong conceptions? So anybody else come up with any interesting points in the discussion in your group?
Towards my body, so that to decrease that that the focus is just nothing but making the body more beautiful, and to get this attachment, and also probably even more important to get attached to others' body.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that combined with the other part of the mindfulness meditation on feelings.
Mm-hmm.
That can decrease the attachment to this whole sexual life, which is basically these two things: to get attached to the to see something pure, which is not pure, and to see something satisfactory, which is not satisfactory.
Mm-hmm.
And it's for me at least, it helps to reduce this attachment.
Yeah. Well, I've got a meditation on the impurity of the body for us to do, if you're willing, via the Venerable Antonio. You know, heard of the Venerable Antonio?
Yeah.
The weekend course? Uh-huh.
Yeah, so
how long did you spend in a course with him?
It was 4 days.
What days?
4 or 5 days.
In Hungary or in London?
No, just here.
Mm. Did you do a meditation on the impurity of the body?
No, it was a classical Vipassana.
Well, just impermanence of mind. Mm. Yeah, well, I've just been in the south of France, Nalanda, the monastery there, FPMT. But next door, well, a few kilometres away, there's a Vajiragini Institute, which is also, you know, giving courses for all sorts of people. And Venerable Antonio had just been there, just finished a course when I was visiting. So these papers were, you know, kind of still in the meditation room. Picked one up. I met him, but didn't know him very well. I met him once or twice, places like Bodh Gaya. So this was obviously part of his retreat. I think that was a 10-day retreat in Vajragini Institute. So about 70 people had gone there. So it is a sort of practice where people are attracted to. I mean, he's got a personal reputation for doing it very well, and, you know, very skillfully and very sort of humorously as well, probably. So it's somehow. But it seems like this is a kind of meditation that people like to do. It says foulness of body. I don't know, call it foulness of body. If it's not really horrific meditation. Just breaking the mind, the meditation down into parts. So don't be afraid that it's going to give you, you know, make you into a, what do you call it? What are those people who don't eat anything? No. People who have, they're so neurotic about their body image that they, you know, they don't eat neurotically. Neurotically, they starve themselves. Anorexia, yeah. So it doesn't want to turn you into somebody who's got a really neurotic complex about your body, like an anorexic or a person with bulimia, you know, by doing one of these meditations where you get really, you know, negative attitude towards your own body. You don't know that. But you're not that kind of person, you know, not beginners or anything. But it's not really about how disgusting the body it is, but it's just a way of kind of standing back from the ordinary attachment, which is very useful, where, of course, if you're a monk, but, of course, if you're a layperson, it's not like you don't have to control your sense of attachment to, you know, other people and so on. It's something you do need to, you know, sort of be able to direct in the direction it should go in and, you know, withhold it in the direction it should be withheld from. So that's something that everybody has to do. So it's a meditation from that point of view. Yeah, so that would be just another affliction, another, you know, instead of being attachment to a body, it's aversion to your body. So that's unskillful, yeah. So we're not trying to promote that. So yes, that's a good point. And these things are sensitive issues, certainly, for some people, that you have to do these things sort of balanced and mature way. And some of these meditations are quite strong. The ones on the impurity of the body, I suppose, especially for people trying to stay celibate altogether. I don't know. But the style of the meditation intrigues me. You know, when I was at the Institute of Buddhist Dialectics, Josh was there. Some of you know Josh. Many of you know him, I think. And, you know, he'd sort of had this association with monasticism in Thailand before he decided to ordain in the Tibetan tradition. So he had kind of been over to places like Thailand and, you know, experienced the life of monks there. Not as ordained person, but, you know, that's where his imprint to become a monk or something had been awakened, probably. And, you know, Thailand. And so then when we had a holiday in the School of Dialectics, he used to go off sometimes, quite often, you know, in the winter, that is, we'd have a long break, a couple of months. He used to go to Burma or Thailand and do this kind of meditation, Vipassana meditation. He wasn't doing the Shinne, the calm abiding meditation, where you're just strictly trying to concentrate your mind, is doing this one, which is more on the wisdom side. And, you know, it's like our principal was sort of very suspicious. Principal Dosan Gyatso, you know, as if he was doing something, taking the easy way out, or, you know, like, that's what they do, they're Hinayanists or something, you know. You don't want to get caught up with them. I'm exaggerating. Our principal was quite a broad-minded person, but he did say something like to Josh once or twice. So, you know, there's some kind of Tibetan view that, you know, there's certain ways of practicing which aren't so beneficial. So I think that is something to do with how much you're analysing or how much you're using reasoning. So the way you describe the meditation, you aren't expected to bring your kind of, you know, your thoughts about, let's investigate this object now and let's really see how we can sort of prove that it's impermanent or something. You don't bring those to the table. You're just supposed to sit there and let your sensitivity to the object increase. And then, you know, impermanence is supposed to arise to your mind as you get more of your attention just placed on the object. And less of your attention bothering about the pain or whatever, and you get over the initial kind of, you know, problems. It's the mind starts to gather its contact and just sort of, you know, like mindfulness says it just keeps close to the object, you see. So that's the question in my mind really when I was asking you about how you should proceed. If you accept those, you know, premises that it's our wrong ways of thinking, that's our wrong ways of sort of grasping onto objects that's causing our grief. You know, the four sort of misconceptions. Then how you work at sort of, you know, undermining them? How you sort of what's the antidote to them? So the way we were taught, you know, you always have to sort of reason, know all the answers, and I'd be able to answer the question why it's impermanent and be able to prove it with a reason, and that you ought to be able to prove that your reason is the correct reason. And it's not just a sort of a fake reason which doesn't stand up to being questioned and debated. So it was really like that, and a really sort of, straightforwardly philosophical approach. Whereas you go over, in my mind, the opposite of that is go over to some sort of the Burmese tradition, Thai tradition, and they're not emphasizing, you know, using a path of reasoning at all. They're just saying, just sit there and, you know, get on with it. Just watch the breath. You might be doing other meditations like some people do the scanning through the body, don't they? You go from the crown of your head down through the limbs and down through the torso and that. So you just sort of spend time on each part, sort of kind of up to you. How long? I don't know. It's not like sort of how strictly it's timed or focused or anything. But I think Goenka meditators, they practice that kind of scanning the body, don't they? I don't know if anybody here has done a Goenka course, have you? Very popular, certainly in India, you know, not just in the West. And that's how people describe doing the meditation. Developing your concentration, really sort of getting down to kind of molecular level, or really sort of fine sort of awareness of how the body's working. And then, you know, the idea is it's impermanent and it's sort of suffering. Those ideas come quite as part of the event, you know. It's not like you have to be told to look for them, or you know, that's when you go to have your interview with your master, that he's giving you reasons why they are. I think it's much more of a process of what happens when you get sensitized properly to what the object's actually like by spending more time looking at it. So I don't know. What do you think about that? Thank you. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
They just stay in the present moment. They don't, there is teaching, but there isn't that real investigative analysis at that point.
Yeah.
Some, but not knowing here what we do here. But here we don't have that sort of abiding in the present moment first, that real sort of before we start the process of reasoning.
Yes. Yeah, the preliminary sort of efforts in the Tibetan tradition when you're sitting down to meditate seems much more like getting the blessings of the guru, you know, really inspiring the mind to some sort of level of, to be able to think at a subtler level or be able to, you know, proceed at a subtler level of energy through blessings of the three jewels and so forth. But yeah, there's obviously a practice of quiescence, there's obviously a practice of calm abiding. You know, there's obviously a practice of settling the mind. I mean, that's got to happen as well. And you've got to have morality, you know, the external conditions of... well, not external, the additional conditions, I mean. You know, you're not going to have a calm mind in any way to be able to do anything with it unless you're keeping good morality. So that's always a, you know, a requirement. And then the external conditions of, you know, a quiet place, free from disturbance, free from noise, you know, all those things. But so if we look at the what the actual sort of definition, if you like, of the close placement of mindfulness, that's given on page 181 here. We'd like to look at that in the handbook. Top of page 181. The definition of a close placement of mindfulness. There's always got to be a definition, you see. Something to debate about. Is an exalted knower, and that simply means, I think, a knower of somebody who's entered the path. Of course, we can do a similitude of a similitude and all that, but the actual one, you've already entered a path, so it's right from the beginning. You can do it right from the first path, from the path of accumulation. But it's still there in the Buddha's mind, so it's not doesn't go away. It's not something you grow out of. It's just get deeper and deeper into it. Okay, so an exalted knower, that just means a consciousness, included within either mindfulness or wisdom, that meditates on the four, bodies, feelings, minds, and phenomena, through examining specific and general characteristics of each of them. So you have two mental factors working, mindfulness and wisdom. And in the definition that we used to get at our, you know, Drepung Losaling College, it said, a mindfulness which investigates. So even the mindfulness was supposed to be investigative. So it's not just simply you glue your mind to the object, which is, that's kind of part of what mindfulness is. You know, you just keep the mind on the object. But you keep the mind on the object mindfully, so you're kind of aware of the characteristics of the object, and you know, you are sort of investigating them. So that investigation can, I think, just be like just investigating in a passive way. Okay, let the object come up and just see what it's like. It doesn't have to be like actively, you know, going from one side to the other and looking from this side, looking from that side. I don't think. You know, it just means that you are kind of. Weighing the object up, assessing it, and kind of, you know, trying to get sort of a sort of full picture of it. And then wisdom, that definitely suggests investigation to me. Definitely suggests you are trying to probe into it, trying to, you know, get a correct view of it, whatever, by whatever means. So then the four objects, the bodies, feelings, minds, and phenomena, through examining the specific and general characteristics of them. So the specific characteristics are the characteristics that each individual one has, like the characteristic of a mind is knowing. So that's its function, you know, so that's what it does. It sort of gets at objects, it apprehends them. And the characteristics of feeling, you know, that's to experience something as pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. So each of the different things you're meditating on, the breath or whatever it is, have their own specific, unique features. So you're aware of those. You're aware of those. And then the general characteristics are those that we keep mentioning. So whether it is pure, impure, whether it is impermanent, permanent, suffering, or so part of the sort of suffering of samsara, it's a purified object, whatever, and then does it have a self or not? So those are the general characteristics, the four characteristics. So that's in an appendix. You see, there's a special appendix on the four close placements of mindfulness, so that it's considered to be something that's worth spending a bit of time on in your progress through the fourth chapter. But I won't read much more of it. But there is a little section at the bottom where it says, what about the Mahayana mindfulness, the Mahayana close placements of mindfulness? So, that's supposed to have some sort of superior qualities. Well, it gives a list of 14, and Asanga, in the works by Asanga on the hearer's progress, it talks about 14 benefits, but I think we only have to mention, really, one, it's supported by compassionate bodhicitta, so you are doing this, trying to do this for the sake of all sentient beings. It's not just for your own, get rid of your own contaminated body and be in your own solitary nirvana. And the other one is that it's the wisdom that's going on is also to see the emptiness of the object. You're not just trying to see the object through selfless in that way that the hearers meditate, the self-sufficient substance of the existent person, the absence of that, but you are trying to see the absence of true existence as well. You're bringing your Mahayana sort of a understanding of emptiness at a deeper level, you're bringing that into it too. So you are just like we talked about this morning, so that's present, or that's you're working towards that as well. So I don't know, 14 points, that seems a bit too many, really. No need to be quite so superior. So 14 points of superiority. Who am I to judge? Can't say anything about Asanga, for heaven's sake. This is teaching at hand, you say? Uh-huh. Is it? Yeah, sure. Okay. So, objects that come up in both in Nyanaponika Thera's book, which is he's from Sri Lanka. Well, his tradition is from Sri Lanka. Maybe he was a German monk or something. But he's trainees in Sri Lanka. But also Asanga, the meditation objects. They talk about meditating on the breath, meditating on the body's unattractiveness, which we can try and do. And then they talk about the charnel ground meditations. These are the people who have very strong desire. You have to bring down your attachment by meditating on corpses as a way of seeing how anything that's made of flesh is also ultimately corrupt and completely impure by meditating corpses or visualizing them, at least in your mind. So I don't think we'll be doing that one today. And then the other one is the body's essential features. So that one is seems to be like where you're breaking the body down into parts from the point of view of seeing there's no self there. You can break it down into the elements: earth, air, fire, water, space, mind. The elements of that way. Or you can break it down into the parts, spatial parts or whatever, sparse distributed through space. But they seem to both mention this idea of meditating on the body's parts in terms of the four elements, which I've never tried to do. So those are some meditations we could try after the tea break, if you would like. Oh, really?
And in the terrorism system, it is being aware of the moment, but within the Mahayana, it is bringing to mind, remembering, teaching.
Yes. Our Sangha is saying that mindfulness here, so you're mindful of the Dharma instructions pertaining to the body, so you're doing the meditation on the body. So first of all, you're remembering the instructions, so that's mindfulness, as well as the meanings of the Dharma instructions. So you're remembering the meaning of what you're supposed to be doing. So that having been established in the mind, they're kept clearly present there through reflection and meditation. It is also the mind's avoidance of inattentiveness, while those expressions and meanings are being clearly kept clearly present there. Yeah, so attentiveness, it's like being keeping your mind on the object. So the close placement of mindfulness is when the mindfulness has been closely placed so that one can determine all such things as: are all the Dharma instructions well retained in my mind or not? Have they been well considered in every way by wisdom or not? Has liberation been properly attained in relation to everything or not? So he's definitely got the three wisdoms there. He's got the wisdom of hearing your instructions and remembering them. So that could lead to maybe correct belief. That's like you can understand the instructions and you're going along with them. So you've got some kind of belief there, and then you have the wisdom arising from reflection. So you're applying your mind to the object, and what you've been told about the object. Then you convert your sort of contemplation into an actual inference, realizing that through on the basis of a reasoning. So that's wisdom arising from reflection. And then at the highest level, when you're getting towards liberation, then you are converting your inferential cognizer, your inference, into a direct perception. So that's going, meditating the reason long enough so that then you start to see the object directly. So that's the bottom line in the commentators, such as Gyaltsabje, Jerenpish's sort of chief disciple, one of his chief disciples. You want to realize something subtle like emptiness or selflessness or impermanence, then the only way you will realize it for the first time is through a reasoning, is through an inference. So they're very clear about that. It sounds maybe it's a bit doctrinaire or something, but so even somebody who's meditating and just trying to do it in a very much more observational, patient way, they say right at the moment when you still realize, oh, everything is impermanent, or everything is just changing moment by moment, or whatever it is, you know, even this sort of, you know, cup in front of me that seems quite so hard and solid, yeah, even that's impermanent. It would come to them through reasoning. And presumably, I don't know whether the people in Burma or Thailand, how they'd react to that. But maybe say, you're wasting too much time thinking about it, just get on with it. I don't know. But yeah, so mindfulness is you know, coming at the object with wisdom and, you know, sort of from different directions, keeping the mind attentive to the object. It's not just staying in the present moment, let's say. Shall we take a cup of tea then? Then we'll have some time to meditate. Yes, please. No, that beaker was fine. Oh, well, no need to waste a one. If I had my old one here, you could. No, this is going to take. Oh, thanks.